In this hour of Focus 580, everything you ever wanted to know about mummies. We'll be talking this morning with Heather Pringle. She is a science journalist who has for over 20 years now been working especially in the fields of archaeology and anthropology. She has traveled all over the world and has written for many different publications, including National Geographic Traveler, Discover, Science, Geo, just to name a few. And this morning we'll be talking about a recent book that she has authored that's titled The Mummy Congress. The subtitle is Science, Obsession, and the Everlasting Dead, which in part explores why it is that we find mummies fascinating, generally why we as individuals find them fascinating, why people who do research on them also find them fascinating, and the various things that mummies can tell us about not only who these people were and how they lived, but can say things about how we think about beauty, what politics really mean then and now. They have some things to tell us about medicine and disease. It's quite an interesting subject, and she explores that in the book, which is published by, let me see, who is the publisher on this book? Thea, I think. Hyperion is an imprint of Hyperion. So you can go out and look for the book. It is titled The Mummy Congress. And then, of course, if you have questions, comments, you can give us a call, 333-WILL here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Ms. Pringle, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And so I'm sorry I sort of stumbled over your publisher here. I guess I guess I'm not familiar with this imprint.
It's a new imprint, so don't feel badly.
All right. Well, anyway, the book is out there, and if people want to read it, they certainly should look for it. The title comes from a meeting that you attended. In fact, has been going on for a while. It's a gathering of various kinds of researchers and scholars and people who are interested in mummies.
Yeah.
And apparently it's not a particularly high-profile event. And in fact, you write in the book that even though you've been writing about archaeology for a long time, until relatively recently, you had never heard of the Mummy Congress.
Oh, well, that's absolutely true. And I found out about it quite almost by accident. I was at the time sort of casting around for story ideas for Discover magazine. They had asked me to try to find new mummy research that would make a suitable article. So I was calling around, and as I say, quite by chance, one of the researchers just mentioned that there was going to be this gathering of mummy experts from around the world. And as soon as I heard this, sort of all my journalist bells started going off. And I thought, gee, this sounded incredibly interesting, you know, to think that mummy experts would be coming from all over the world to present their findings. Just seemed too hard to resist.
Mm. And, of course, when one says the word mummy, immediately everyone thinks Egypt.
Exactly. When I went to the Congress, it was held in a little place, a little city in Chile called Arica in northern Chile. And I started attending the sessions and listening to the various papers that the researchers were presenting. I was really amazed to find out that there had been mummies on every continent on Earth. There had been, for example, researchers were reporting finds of mummies from, let's say, Lebanon. These were mummies of people who had fought during the Crusades in Lebanon. They were telling stories about the mummies of Buddhist monks in Japan, and these were individuals who had actually practiced a form of self-mummification during their lives. So, in other words, they had tried to mummify themselves by eating a very particular diet. They had abstained from all grains and rice, for example, and they had nibbled on a type of nut known as the turia nut, and they had sipped at bowls of lacquer, which is the stuff that most of us put on furniture.
Hmm.
So, as I say, I heard stories of these Buddhist monks from Japan, and of course, there were many reports of mummies from South America. The little city of Arica is, in fact, sort of perched on the edge of the Atacama Desert, which is one of the driest places on Earth, if not the driest place on Earth, and it provides a natural environment for the preservation of human flesh. It's just so very dry there that it dries cadavers and naturally mummifies the dead. So, I think it's important to point out that to a mummy expert, mummies are not just sort of dead folks wrapped in linen, which is what I think most of us would think of, we think of Egyptian mummies, to a mummy expert, a mummy is any body that resists the natural process of decay. Mm. So in other words, this could be, for example, one of the children that have been found on the tops of South American mountains. These are the Inca children. So it could be a frozen child from a mountaintop, or it could be a body found in the bogs of Northern Europe. You know, there's just a vast range of you know, mummies that scientists were talking about.
Yeah, it's interesting because this goes to the very question of, well, what is it exactly that we're talking about?
Exactly.
Because there are examples of mummies that were the deliberate effort,
yes,
or deliberate attempts at people to preserve the bodies and prevent them from decaying. But then, depending upon natural conditions, there are also places that it's just happened because,
yes,
because of the virtues of the environment and the place. So it gets to this question. Well, as I said, when you say mummy, people think about Egypt and they think about these people wrapped in strips of linen, and that it's really much, much more than that.
Yes, absolutely. And I think people may be surprised to learn that, in fact, the human art of mummification was really quite widespread. In other words, it certainly wasn't confined to Egypt. There were very proficient mummifiers in northern Chile. In fact, we often think that Egypt was the birthplace of mummification, but in reality, the very earliest what I would call artificial mummies, those are mummies made by human beings, the very earliest artificial mummies, in fact, come from northern Chile, and they date back about 7,000 years, which is around 2,500 years before the Egyptians began to embalm their dead. So, you know, certainly, as I say, Chile, you know, there were morticians in northern Chile 7,000 years ago. There were certainly cultures in North America which practice mummification on the Aleutian Islands, which are just off the coast of Alaska. There were, again, some very, very proficient mummifiers living on those islands in prehistoric times, and they also mummified their dead. And then, of course, across Europe in medieval times, the art of mummification was well known in many other parts of the world. So we're certainly not just talking about Egypt here. Mm.
And it's interesting, I guess, if you think about it in one way, that it is a kind of a window into the human psyche.
Absolutely.
Because obviously all you would, as a human being, and I'm sure that people noticed this a long, long time ago, all you have to do is observe for a little while. When something dies, you know what happens to it.
Yes,
it decays.
Exactly.
It decomposes. And so it must very well be that it didn't take people very long to make the leap and or start thinking about, well, gosh, when I die, this is going to happen to me.
Yes.
And the idea of death and decay is, I guess, has never been particularly appealing to human beings. And so there seems to be an impulse that came into play here, probably very early, that people somehow had this idea that if we can preserve this physical structure, the skin and the bones, and as much as we possibly can, then somehow that means that we won't really die and decay and disappear, that somehow, one way or another, it's going to help us make the leap from this plane of existence that we're in to whatever we think the next plane of existence is.
Yes, very definitely. And one thing I'd like to point out, it seems that, it certainly wasn't a case where, for example, one culture sort of developed mummification and then sort of exported that idea to many other cultures around the world. It seems to be, you know, that doesn't really appear to be the case. What seems to have happened is that human cultures in many different parts of the world discovered how to preserve the dead on their own using just a really wide range of techniques. Now, what I think, and I'm certainly not alone in thinking this, many mummy experts are starting to credit this idea as well. It seems to be that when human beings discovered how to preserve food, in other words, you know, when a hunter went out and, let's say, shot a deer, there were certain things that hunters often did. I mean, they took out, they gutted the animal, took out the internal organs. That was a way of trying to preserve the carcass a little bit longer. And certainly human societies developed a vast range of techniques, everything from smoking meat to drying meat, salting meat, and so on. And I think really what happened in many, many parts of the world was that human societies really just adapted those technologies for extending the shelf life of food, and they adapted them to human beings. And so, as I say, I don't believe it was a case that, for example, the Egyptians exported this technology far and wide. I think that human societies, developed food preservation techniques on their own and then applied them to human beings.
We're talking this morning with Heather Pringle. She's a science writer who specializes in writing about archaeology, ancient cultures. She's written for many different magazines, including Discover and National Geographic, Traveler, and Science, among others. And she is also the author of two books, including In Search of Ancient North America, and the one that here we're talking about this morning, The Mummy Congress, Science, Obsession, and the Everlasting Dead. And it's got some really interesting things in there if you'd like to take a look at it. It's out there in the bookstore. And questions here are welcome. We have one person who is ready to go. We'll get right to. Others are welcome to call 333-9455 for folks here in Champaign-Urbana. And if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Farmer City, line number 4. Hello. Yeah.
Good morning. I'm looking forward to reading your book. I have two subjects I wanted you to address. The first is, I wonder if you could go into the practice in 19th century Egypt. I understand that mummies were used for fuel in the steam engines. Mm-hmm. I can't think of a better metaphor of a decaying culture, literally burning its own dead and its own heritage. Could you address that subject?
I did, in fact. Now, it's very interesting, the origins of that story. It was, in fact, Mark Twain who first recorded that anecdote in Innocents Abroad, I believe it was. And he described engineers on Egyptian railways asking for, it was kind of a funny remark Twain quotes. He says, one engineer asked, said that the plebeian bodies weren't burning at all well, and could they please throw a king or a pharaoh up front, because perhaps that would burn a little bit better in the firebox. In fact, I think really Mark Twain had his tongue in his cheek when he was writing that. They're really... aren't any other kind of historic sources that really support that contention, at least not that I was able to uncover, nor that other mummy experts have been able to uncover. So I sort of think that that Mark Twain was having a bit of fun with that. Certainly mummies were, almost ubiquitous in Egypt. I read some estimates that suggest that there were in the order of about 3 million mummies preserved in Egypt. I mean, an extraordinary number by any count. And certainly, people were offering the bodies of Egyptian mummies for sale as souvenirs to travelers who were touring around, wealthy travelers who were touring around in Egypt. So, mummies were highly visible, but as to whether anyone was actually burning the mummies in fireboxes of railway engines, I'm a little skeptical about that myself, mainly because I haven't seen any evidence, and because Mark Twain himself had a little disclaimer at the end of that anecdote saying, just basically that, he took this on faith and we should too. So I think it's a little unlikely, but it makes a great story, and certainly it lingers in just about everyone's mind.
Oh, yeah, so I'll take that as a comfort then. Yeah. Second subject I'd like you to address is the Catholic belief in the incorruptibility of saints.
Yes.
As a proof of sainthood. And if you could just discuss that, and is there some natural process? I mean, is this a common thing if, like, if you dug up anybody, 200 years later, would some of them remain incorrupt without the benefit of sainthood?
It's a great question, and thanks very much for asking that, because I did indeed, I delved into this subject. I was really interested in it myself and have written a chapter about it in my book. what I did was I went to Italy, and I interviewed extensively. I spent quite some time there interviewing two pathologists who have been involved in examinations of the bodies of the incorruptibles in Italy. This is done under the auspices of the church. The Catholic Church is very interested in obtaining information about the lives of the saints. Often the official legends of the saints are a bit scanty on facts sometimes about the lives of the saints, particularly the very early ones, the medieval saints. And so as a result, the Catholic Church has sort of fairly regular examinations of the saints. They also want to make sure that they're being kept in, you know, good condition and so on. So these two pathologists have been studying the incorruptibles and have come to a number of conclusions about them. There are some instances in the cases of some of the saints. This is a rather small number, but I would say that there have been about 30 or 40 saints who have been carefully examined, and a very small number of them from medieval times, from a very specific period, 13th and 14th century in Italy. These saints were, in fact, artificially mummified. The practice was very well known in Europe at the time, contrary to what most of us might believe. The practice of mummification was frequently mummification was frequently performed in the courts of Europe in order to preserve the bodies of royalty for their state funerals. And so this knowledge was certainly present in European society, and when these two pathologists have examined some of the bodies of saints, they have seen the clear signs of artificial mummification. In other words, the incisions along the abdomen, and they have seen the removal of internal organs, and sort of some of the sort of very standard techniques of almost Egyptian-style mummification, I would say, the use of aromatic herbs and herbs that possess antibacterial properties that really assist in the preservation of the human body. So, as I say, there is a very small number of those saints which have been, whose preservation has been assisted in this way. And then there are saints who have been whose bodies were anointed at the time of death with various kinds of plant resins which are known to be antibacterial in nature. And then the bodies were wrapped in linen, and cotton. Both these kinds of wrappings have a kind of wick away the moisture from the body. So again, this sort of assists in the preservation of the body. And in addition, there have been some studies done on the tombs in which some of the saints were initially buried in. They were often buried underneath the church floors in tombs that were carved out of the bedrock. In some cases, the bedrock was a limestone bedrock, and water drains very quickly through limestone. And there was kind of a very kind of arid microclimate created inside these tombs, which again was very conducive to preservation. So there are sort of a number of ways in which, both human beings have assisted in the preservation of some of the saints, and also the environment itself has assisted in the preservation of some of the saints. Now, I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to rule out, divine intervention, and I don't think any pathologist would be willing to state categorically that there was not some other agency acting here as well. But certainly, there does seem to be some, some explanations for how some of the incorruptibles came to be preserved.
I see. One other topic, and then I'll hang up. If you could talk about the lead coffins,
yes,
that were used in at times gave airtight seals, and some of these have been opened and with incorrupt bodies, but then they quickly decayed when exposed to modern air. If you could talk about
yes,
that.
I mean, I came across a fascinating story about this. I thought I went to when I was in London, I went to a company called the Necropolis Corporation, which is just such an evocative name. But it was a company that had been founded in Victorian times. And it was located in a little office in a London suburb, Kingston upon Thames, and it was actually in the 19th century undertaker's office. Anyway, I went to see the people at the Necropolis Corporation, and they were in the business of what they called exhumation. They were exhumation specialists. So in other words, because real estate in London is so valuable, what has happened in recent years is that property developers have actually purchased cemeteries for redevelopment, and this has necessitated the removal of vast numbers of bodies from London cemeteries to new quarters, I should say. So in one particular case, the Necropolis Corporation had removed 15,000 bodies from Islingham, and it was very interesting. We talked about that, and they told me that of those 15,000 bodies, and this is, I just want to emphasize this is in rainy, damp London, two of the bodies that they found were in absolutely pristine condition. And, you know, in fact, one of the gentlemen very kindly showed me some of the documentation. They document the removal of the bodies scrupulously, both with photographs and with detailed notes and so on. So the gentleman at the Necropolis Corporation was very kind to show me some of the photographs from the exhumation. And I must say, you know, the bodies were spectacularly, these two bodies were really wonderfully preserved. They both dated back to the 18th century. And when I asked, you know, why these bodies had been preserved, the gentleman told me that it was likely a combination of things. One was that the body was in one of these lead caskets. Both the bodies were in these lead caskets. They had been, you know, very tightly, you know, caulked with something called Swedish pitch, which was made the casket quite airtight. And then the bodies had been buried in a type of soil in the cemetery in these two spots. It was a very kind of clay type soil, and the there had been almost a vacuum. A natural vacuum that had formed around the lead casket in this kind of clay soil, and the people at the Necropolis Company believed that this was what had led to the preservation of these two bodies. They didn't open. I just want to stress they didn't open up the caskets, but the caskets had these kind of glass plates over the faces, and Roger Weber, the fellow that I interviewed, you know, said it was, you know, for the workers it was quite a shock when they dug down and, you know, cleared away the soil from the glass plate, and there was the face of a woman staring back up at them. I mean, it was just quite an incredible experience for them. But as I say, this was a case of lead caskets that were buried in a clay soil. I believe that the lead casket in itself is not usually enough. It has to be sort of a combination of factors that leads to preservation, at least certainly in a very damp environment like London.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Heather Pringle. She's a journalist, a science writer, who has written a lot about archaeology and anthropology. And if you're interested in mummies, you will certainly be interested in her book, The Mummy Congress, Science, Obsession, and the Everlasting Dead. The publisher on this book is Theia, which is a division of Hyperion. Perfectly appropriate since Theia was Hyperion's wife.
Exactly
so. We're here open to questions. If you'd like to call in, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and also toll-free, 800-222-9455. Back here to another caller, and they're local, I think, in Champaign, I think, on line number one.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
I've got a question I've been dying to ask for years and years and years. I read a statement several years ago that said when they found multitudes of mummies, that a lot of them were sent over here to America, and they were turned into newspaper.
Yes, yes.
Now, could that possibly have been true?
Well, this is a great question. There are so many of these stories that that have sort of percolated through our culture over the years. This is another one of these really fascinating ones. Now, I have to say that I myself, when I was doing the research, I was not able to find any hard evidence of this story. I mean, it's the story, as I understand it, is that during the 19th century, there was a shortage of cotton. At that time, paper was made from cotton and linen rags. I mean, it was very common to do this. And there was a shortage of cloth. And so I believe the story goes that there was a very enterprising entrepreneur who decided to import Egyptian mummies and then strip them of their bandages and then use the bandages as the raw material for paper. And indeed, there's even an additional aspect to this, sort of a curse of the mummy kind of twist to the story. And the story goes that the rags were infected with cholera, that the mummy bandages were in fact infected with cholera, and that cholera spread through the mill, and that eventually the American government had to pass a regulation to prohibit the export of mummy bandages. It's a neat story. It's very colorful, very detailed, but I wasn't able to find any real hard evidence of it. There is a scholar who has written about this story in great detail, a fellow by the name of Joseph Dane, who has written a real neat paper on it. But there are no surviving examples of this paper. There was one account that suggested that there had been a newspaper on the eastern seaboard which had actually published an edition on this paper, but there has been no record found of this paper. So at this point, I would say, to the best of my knowledge, it's a really interesting story, but there doesn't seem to be any really hard proof at the moment that it in fact is true. But, you know, I think the jury's out on that one.
Okay.
Well, thank you. I'd wondered all these years.
All right. Thanks for the question. And apparently there are, as you say, many different stories about unorthodox uses for mummies. One, apparently, though, that is actually true is that mummies were ground up and they were used to make a pigment that was included in paint, artists'
yes,
paint.
Yes, that in fact is verifiable. That story is perfectly true. As hideous as it may sound to us, mummies were exported from Egypt beginning probably in Renaissance times, and it carried through right until, and this is just astonishing, right until the 1904, we know for sure that it was still going on in 1904, because there is a magazine article that was published in London on the use of Egyptian mummies for the paint pigment that was called either mummy or Egyptian brown. It had two names. And the magazine article actually had photographs of people working in what was called a color man's, which was a type of business that supplied artists' materials to artists and performed other kinds of services for artists. And this magazine article actually shows people employed at this firm grinding up Egyptian mummies with a very heavy stone. The powder was then used to make a pigment that was very popular. There are several written accounts of English painters talking about using a mummy or Egyptian brown. And there's actually just a really wonderful story, I think, about two British painters, one being a fellow by Burne Jones and the other one Alma Tadema. And they had both been very interested in painting Egyptian scenes. And Alma Tadema came back one day from visiting his color man, and he had just found out what was actually in mummy. I guess most painters hadn't really realized that there were human bodies being ground up to make this pigment. But when Alma Tadema learned the truth, he came to visit his friend Burne Jones right away, and he explained to him what he had discovered. And Burne Jones went off to his studio and came back with a tube of mummy in his hand. And Burne Jones was just horrified by this, so they had a little ceremony. They dug a hole in the back garden, said a few farewell words, parting words, a little kind of funeral ceremony, and then they buried the tube in the back garden. And, you know, certainly the pigment was very pervasive among European painters.
But apparently a lot of people just thought that it was a cool name, and they didn't really realize that, in fact, it was what it said that it was.
Oh, definitely. I think there was a lot of misconceptions about it, but indeed it was definitely made from human bodies.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Let's continue. We have a number of other callers. Obviously, people are interested in the subject. Let's go to Oaktown, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Touching all the bases this morning. thought occurred to me a few minutes ago that, like in Egypt and China, the very rich and the very powerful mummified their people. But why didn't India do this?
Well, it's an interesting question that you raise here. It's very true that that in civilizations such as Egypt and China, people did in fact reserve mummification, at least initially, for the very rich and powerful. And indeed, this is this practice was true in many other cultures. Many of the other civilizations as well. People reserved this for the rich and powerful. As to why India didn't do it, that's an interesting question. I don't know that I really have the answer for that because...
Well, didn't they just burn the...
They did. Oh, yes, indeed, they did. I have read one account that suggested that in ancient times in Egypt, or pardon me, in India, people did indeed preserve the dead in a honey compound. And then, and only then, did they burn the body. But I wasn't able to verify that, so I didn't take that much further in my research. I'm afraid I don't really have the answer, other than to suggest that religious beliefs in India really ruled that out as being a good funerary practice.
Well, that seems strange,
Yeah, but one thing I do want to point out, though, that it is certainly mummification was practiced. In cultures that were not, sort of these big important civilizations. And I'd just like to go back to a point I made a little bit earlier, which was that the very earliest mummifiers that we know of were in northern Chile. And what I really want to stress here is that in the case of this very early Chilean group, mummification was very elaborate. The mummies were, eviscerated, and then they were coated in a kind of ashy paste that hardened into a almost like a ceramic-like substance, and then the mummies were painted, so they had this almost ceramic-like bodysuit, and with beautifully painted. I mean, these mummies really looked to me like they should be in a museum of fine art. But the very earliest ones that were made it by this particular culture were all children, and it seems to me that the original impulse to mummify the dead, at least in northern Chile, was perhaps arose from a parent's grief. In other words, I can just really see this clearly in my mind's eye, that a mother or a father just could not bear to part with a child. And so, as a result, had devised a way of, keeping the child with them, and to preserve that child's body and to make that child's body beautiful forever, for eternity. Because certainly we still have these bodies 7,000 years later. So, to me, it seems like the original impulse was not to mummify, was not to preserve the high and mighty, but rather it was, a parent trying to preserve the body of a child, a much more kind of human impulse that I think we can all identify with.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Philo for the next caller. It's line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Have you ever heard that cats were shipped to the United States in large quantities to be used as fertilizer from India or Egypt?
Yes, great question. It's really interesting. This is another one of these tales that we hear. And in fact, this one, I believe, is true. Now, I haven't actually heard the mummies in question of cats were Egyptian mummies. The Egyptians mummified millions and millions of cats. I mean, this sounds so strange to our ears today, but they in fact, these cats were intended as offerings to the gods, and the Egyptians actually raised cats in catteries. It was like almost like a factory farm production in some parts of Egypt. And they literally mummified millions of cats as offerings to the gods. The cats were wrapped in linen, very similar to the human mummies. And now, it's very true. I mean, I've certainly read accounts, and this does seem to be well substantiated, that mummies were exported, cat mummies were exported from Egypt to England. To make fertilizer for rose beds, but I haven't actually heard of any instances of this this trade being conducted between Egypt and America. It's possible, but I'm just not aware of it myself.
Okay. So the story about the newspapers, not on that one, but
no.
At least as far as Britain is concerned, cat mummies for fertilizer, yeah.
Yes, exactly, yes.
Okay. To another caller here, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. I had heard that currently bodies are decaying more slowly because of the food preservatives that we consume.
Oh.
So I was wondering if that there was any truth to that, and also how well can we preserve bodies nowadays? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay.
Thanks.
That sounds to has the ring of an urban legend to me.
It's a great, you know, I have to say I hadn't heard that story before about bodies preserving because of all the food preservatives that we eat. You know, I really can't comment on that because I hadn't heard that one before. It does sound intriguing, and but I'm afraid I just can't shed any light on that one at all. As to the second question, however, of how well we preserve bodies today, there's a couple points to this. One, the first is that the embalming that that is very prevalent in North American society today, that tends to be a very kind of short-term process. In other words, it's usually intended just to preserve the body for the funeral proceedings, and is not intended to be a long-term mummification technique. However, there are services in North America that will mummify the dead. There is a company based in Salt Lake City, Utah, a company called Sumum, that will undertake a kind of Egyptian-style mummification. I should say Egyptian-style mummification using some fairly high-technology chemicals and so on today. But Sumum will, in fact, mummify the dead. It is very expensive. I believe it's in excess of $60,000. And then, of course, there's always the option of cryogenics as well, which is the freezing of the human body. And there are several firms in the United States which will agree to preserve the body by means of a freezing, you know, with liquid nitrogen and so on. And I think that you know, both of these represent real options to people who do want to preserve their bodies for a very long period of time.
Hmm. And I'm sure that I had read somewhere recently that freeze-drying had actually been nudging out the traditional art skinning and taxidermy. In preserving animal specimens.
Yes.
I don't know. Are people? One wonders whether anybody's offering that service for you. Your spouse goes, and you'd like to have them arranged tastefully on the couch so that you can sit there and with them offering the same sort of service.
Yeah, I it's funny. I don't know. I haven't come across any services that would offer that. But I'd certainly read the same probably news article that you had about the freeze drying of pets, and it kind of twigged my fancy. I've got kind of an older cat myself right now, so I would like to keep our cat with as long as possible.
We have talked about something about various places that mummies have been found and mummification has taken place, and it seems that in many of them a key item is that the environment is extremely dry.
Yes.
And what happens is that the bodies very quickly become dried out, and that's part of why they are preserved. But it's interesting that in Europe, in Northern Europe, there have been a number of mummies that have come out of bogs.
Yes.
Which is an extremely wet environment, and you'd think, well, this is kind of counterintuitive. I can understand how in Egypt, because it's extremely hot and dry, that this would work toward helping preserve bodies. But how is it that a body could be in a wet environment like that and also be, to a large extent, preserved?
Yeah, great question. To sort of understand it, you have to know a little bit about the decay process. And I promise not to go into any kind of really graphic, gory details. But essentially, decay happens because of a certain kind of protein molecule, certain category of protein molecules, I should say, in our body. These are called enzymes. And These enzymes are really the main agents of decay. We have them in our cells, in the nuclei of our cells, and during our lifetimes, they actually perform a lot of really valuable services. But after we die, these enzymes start leaking out of our cells and start sort of corroding and digesting sort of everything in sight. In addition to that source of enzymes, we also have enzymes in the bacteria of in our intestinal tract, in our GI tract, and again after our death, these bacteria begin chomping through the intestinal walls. They kind of ride the veins, which are the superhighways of our bodies, and they kind of they just kind of go about their dirty business, kind of again digesting everything in sight. And then the third kind of source of enzymes would be the insects that feed on cadavers. So enzymes are really the real agents of decay, as I say. And the real key thing to make in making a mummy is that you have to shut off the enzymes. You have to somehow be able to turn them off. And there are really two ways of doing that. Enzymes are real water lovers. They love water, and they need water in order to decay the body. I mean, they really must have water. So if you deprive them of water, you can shut off the enzymatic decay. That's one way of doing it. But the second way of doing it is to make a chemical environment that is hostile to the enzymes. And this can be done in a variety of ways. In the case of the bog bodies, these are the bodies that are found in the bogs in Northern Europe, there is a chemical environment in the water of the bog that is very hostile to the enzymes. What happens is that there is the chief form of vegetation in a bog is something called sphagnum moss, and as it decays, it produces a series of chemical compounds, each of which is hostile to enzymatic decay, so that in the bogs of Europe, bodies that are placed in there are preserved. They're almost the bodies looked almost as if they have been tanned. If you think about leather, they almost look like kind of a leathery, brittle leather when they're dried after being taken out of the bog. But that's sort of what these enzymes do to the bodies. But it preserves, that's what this chemical environment does to the bodies, and it can preserve bodies. Bog bodies for literally thousands of years. We certainly have bog bodies that go back to the Roman era and beyond.
We have another caller here in a couple minutes. I'm trying to get them in, and they're in Indiana on our line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Why, freeze drying is difficult because of the fat in the body, for one thing. That's the first thing I want to say, but I have another story about papyrus. It's not about, mummies, but I wonder if you might be able to answer this question.
I'll try.
I was traveling in Europe a few years back, and I met a woman on the train whose nephew wanted her to bring him back a sheet of papyrus. And she said, you know where I can buy it? I said, no, I had no idea. But anyway, later on, I was in the British Museum, and I thought, well, if it's available at all, it should be here. And I asked the sales lady, and she said, no, but why don't you go back and talk to Dr. Baker about this? And she said, you go past the Elgin Marbles and turn left and then right, which I did, and came to the door to the laboratory, rang the bell. One of his assistants took me back to see him. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, about papyrus. He says, well, we've been trying to make it here, and we get papyrus from Kew Gardens, and then we interlay it and pound it. And he says, well, we've never been very successful at making it. But anyway, he gave me a couple of blades of papyrus, which I wished I'd smuggled back into the country because it was such an unusual souvenir. But anyway, a couple of years later, there was an article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal in that column that's devoted to cultural things rather than financial, and it talked about that papyrus is being made today. Now, do you have any idea of what or where?
It's not really an area that I've done very much research on, but I will say that certainly in Cairo, There is actually an institute in which people at least profess to be making papyrus by traditional techniques. As to the you know, the real degree of accuracy, I'm afraid I can't really tell you that. But I too have had that experience in the British Museum of taking that left turn and the right turn, and then ringing the bell and going down to visit the Egyptologists who are sort of installed in the British Museum in the basement.
And there were lots of cat mummies there.
Yes, yes, I know the place that you're talking about, but I'm really sorry, I just can't comment on that.
And I'm afraid that we're going to have to stop because we've used our time, and there is so much that we could talk about, including medical research on mummies and other sorts of things, and we just have to call a halt for the moment. But maybe on a future day, maybe when the book comes out in paper, we should say if you'd be willing to spend another hour with us, we could find some more things to talk about.
Oh, I'd love to, and by all means, yes.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure, David.
Our guest, Heather Pringle, and again, her book is titled The Mummy Congress, Science, Obsession, and the Everlasting Dead, published by Theia, which is an imprint of Hyperion. You certainly should be able to find it out in the bookstore now.